Well, after nearly 3 months of higher weekly closes, the gold stampede paused this week, giving investors time to appreciate their gains, one of the hottest sectors of 2014, and the amazing equities bull market, though, continued to gain momentum. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back here with you this weekend. In this must-hear show, a doubleheader with two top must-hear guests this weekend. First up, it's Charles Goyette. According to the best-selling author, Western powers may be inciting the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, attempting to get their hands on the gold stockpile, as well as the strategic gas pipelines in the region. Gold may be the go-to investment, though, if tensions continue, sending billions of investors rushing into the safe haven. Silver is also an underdog, but according to Charles, not for long. It'll only require a few billionaires to get interested in silver to send it to triple-digit numbers. Then, after correctly predicting the gold market bottom in December of last year, Bob Hoy returns to the show with his latest overview. He expects the pause in market momentum to present priceless opportunities for investors to accumulate and profit from the precious metals recovery. He outlines startling parallels between past economic crises and the current economic conditions in a world where economic collapse is becoming increasingly likely. And we'd like for you to call in with your questions and comments. You can do so on our toll-free hotline, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can leave your first name or keep anonymous if you prefer. The toll-free hotline, please jot it down, 1-800-507-6531. And did you know that if you can own a basket of top gold stocks and still earn 10 to 11% per year? No more excuses. I can't invest in gold because it just doesn't return much to keep the lights on and help pay the monthly bills. Well, how about a basket of diversified gold stocks with a monthly paycheck? That's right, a monthly dividend check of around 11%. Well, the Alpha Stocks newsletter has the ticker symbol posted right now for you. What are you waiting for? This one pick alone, and sometimes I put up two or three a day, is worth the price of at least an annual subscription. The show begins now. Cloudy weather appeared over the precious metals exchanges for the first time in nearly 3 months, primarily due to dollar strength as investors booked some profits on the metals, preferring the U.S. dollar due to hasty comments made by the new Fed chair. Still, the sell-off was tame as news of continued tensions between the West and Russia over Ukraine made the headlines. Gold remains the investment du jour for 2014, the best-performing investment class overall, trading up over 10%, whereas the S&P 500 has added little more than 1% for the year. At Friday's closing bell in the New York COMEX Exchange, gold was off less than 50, finishing at $13.34, still well above support. Silver lost a little more than a dollar, still holding above $20 support at $20.14. Palladium bucked the trend, gaining about 3% on the week, higher by more than 21, and finishing just shy of $800. The metal was given a push higher by two new palladium-backed ETFs expected on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Platinum lost about $33, finishing at $14.37, and West Texas Intermediate crude gained about half a dollar, closing at $99.55 per barrel. Well, the top story impacting the precious metals markets this week was clearly the comments from our new Fed chair, Dr. Yellen, who said on Wednesday that the bond buying program could be tapered sooner than expected and then followed by rate hikes. At her first news conference as the Fed chair, Dr. Yellen noted that rates could climb as soon as April or May of 2015. That's about 6 months sooner than previously anticipated. At the FOMC meeting, Fed governors agreed to reduce their asset purchases by about $10 billion. So now they're down from about $85 billion per year to $55 billion per year. That's three reductions in a row, consecutive reductions. Market watchers noted that the Fed comments were probably a bit overdone here due to, well, related learning curve. The second big story driving the markets is the ongoing dispute between the West and Russia regarding Ukraine, which escalated a bit this week as Russia officially annexed Crimea, despite the accord signed by the European Union with Ukraine, and amid comments from the White House of U.S. financial sanctions against Russia. Russia remains the world's largest producer of palladium, probably another reason for the pop higher this week in that metal. On a positive note, demand from China for gold is expected to pick up soon amid more favorable seasonal factors. Plus, economists expect India to continue lifting gold import restrictions ahead of impending elections in a bid to appease disgruntled investors and aficionados. Increased Eastern-related purchases could help the precious metal sector gain traction for the next leg higher in this recovery. Bottom line on gold and silver. Well, after nearly three consecutive months of higher highs in the gold market, the bull stampede, well, it took a pause. The herd needs fresh water and some grazing time. There's nothing really but good news, though, in the charts for virtually every related sector. So for next week's forecast and all the stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week on positive comments from the FOMC meeting over economic growth expectations. Investors interpreted the rate increase comments from the Fed chair as a sign that the Great Recession is in the rearview mirror and the conflict between Ukraine and Russia is not likely to extend beyond the confines of that geographic region. For the week, the Dow added about 237, that's just over 1.5%, ending at 16,302, while the S&P 500 picked up 25, about 1.4%, ending at 1866, and the NASDAQ picked up about 31 points, not quite 1%, ending at 4279. Well, all eyes were on the FOMC meeting this week. Officials blamed the sluggish economic growth over the winter on frigid conditions. They did note lackluster housing recovery as well as low inflation. And I think that this is clear that there's plenty of slack still in the system for continued stimulus, especially if we see national unemployment continue to inch higher. So it appears that the equities market views the current Fed outlook as a Goldilocks scenario, neither too hot nor too cold, just right. Bottom line, well, the seven-component market sentiment indicator is neutral. Again, neither too much greed nor too much fear. So I expect some indecision in the markets as they mull over the latest FOMC statement. The month-long consolidation is likely to continue for the foreseeable future. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Charles Goyette and Bob Hoy. So we'd like for you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Joining me with his unique technical and fundamental outlooks, it's Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you. And we live in interesting times.
That's right. You know, we've seen one of the most impressive rallies in gold and silver, as well as the XAU, in, well, over the course of the last 15, 20 years. The bears would argue that it is a bounce, if you will, a rebound from deeply oversold conditions.
Yeah, well, what we were looking at in November was that all the commodity side metals, base metals and precious metals, and crude and grains and all that sort of stuff were getting really kind of oversold. So what we called it was a rotation, that some of the very high flying stocks would stop flying, and that we called them the low flyers on the resource side would set a bottom maybe December and then rally up into the spring. Some of the rallies have been absolutely fabulous. Some of our favorite juniors have really jumped, and that has worked out. So what we're looking at now on the near term is that for the gold, leading gold and silver stocks have reached pretty good momentum. And on one of our models, Silver Standard has reached an exhaustion mode. So it had been a whole lot faster and better than what we thought was possible. And our advice now on the precious metal sector would be to take some money off the table for those who are nimble enough to do it. And if you can't, there's going to be a bit of a setback for a while. It's just, Chris, it's been so good. And I've seen there one of my favorites from $1.01. It's sort of the lows in December to $1.95. I mean, does it get any better? So that's the view. So, but on the bigger picture, and we're looking at financial history here, where we are completing the first bull market and the first economic expansion out of a classic 1929 crash. I mean, it was almost as bad as that. It was all, and there was a previous one as well, 1873. It was an outstanding crash and contraction. So our view on this first business expansion was that it would be a weak recovery, but we didn't really have an idea of how long it would go. But now we're at 5 years since the panic ended, and that panic was in lower-grade bonds and in stocks, and that ended in March of 2009. The recovery business side, the economic side, came in real fast because the NBER decided that the recession was over in that June. So let's look at here. We've now got 5 years on a bull market, and that bull market includes lower-grade bonds. And you're also 5 years on an economic expansion. Now, some of the economist guys think that you have to have, to conclude a business cycle, you've got to have a pretty strong economy. But our case is that in a post-bubble post-bubble contraction, you won't get a strong economy. And the timing would be more the determinant on it, and we're at 5 years. Then also on the orthodox investment world with stocks, which became very overbought and with great sentiment figures in January. And these are at reached levels that you only see at a cyclical high for the stock market. And in the past, whenever these have been reached, you don't sort of have a like a 15% setback, and then the major senior indexes then start to trade sideways. You have to go through the whole cycle, and one of the thing conditioners on that, of course, is the credit cycle, where you had credit instruments, the lower-grade ones, absolutely devastated in February, March, 5 years ago. We're now up there in Never Never Land. You got yields for junk bonds below 6%. Default rate has been low, so and the momentum has been high. So let's just take a look at the junk bond, JNK. And it recently got up to an RSI of 73, and that hasn't been seen since the 1st of May a year ago when a seasonal rally topped out and was followed by a pretty hard slam in lower-grade bond prices. So what we have here now is you've had, right at, in early January, the spread, the credit spreads. And as we would like to joke, for equity people, there's only two times when you want to look at credit spreads, and that's at the bottom of a panic, and the other is at the high confidence of a market top, which we are now. So we've had some widening of credit spreads that hasn't been seen since 2008. That's serious. And there's been a hit and then a little confusion with the problems in Crimea and Ukraine. And then things have been positive this week, but the credit spread side is vulnerable. And the way we relate that to the precious metals market is that in a business expansion, the gold shares don't do so well because the ordinary stock market is doing very well. And then in the post-bubble contraction, when you eventually get the real price of gold going up and profitability returning to most operations, then you can have a real bull market for the stock. And so here we are. You have had a fabulous bull market for stocks and low-grade bonds. You've had at times a very dismaying bear market for the precious metals. And on the big picture, we'd say that the bear market for precious metals probably has ended, but it's going to be bottoming for a while. And at the same time, you've had the blow-off, which is still on, in stocks and bonds. So on an ideal world, as the big stock market rolls over, this will bring in the next phase of weakening economy and weakening resource prices and everything else, and in which case, in a post-bubble credit contraction, the gold sector has done the best, and we're looking forward to that. It may take us, Chris, maybe 5 or 6 months before we get into a strong market based on a post-bubble contraction. So, but we like the sector for the long term.
Very good. Well, you know, the gold stocks are typically viewed as leveraged plays on the precious metals. So far, 2014 has been very kind to the XAU after several difficult years. It's really one of the hottest sectors. I wonder if you could tell listeners what has renewed or piqued your interest in these precious metal stocks.
Well, that they were wrung out and dead dull in December. And but you know, you had two in here that the one that led the market was, believe it or not, was the Silver Standard, SSIR in the States. And it had its low in October, and then everything else was having lows in December, and it came down and was testing low. Also, Pan American Silver, PAAS, was another good trading silver stock that was sort of in December beginning to resist the decline in other silver stocks and the decline in the gold stocks. And we looked at it and said, hey, and we consider those, not unkindly, but just as the dogs of the silver market, and we said if the dogs in the silver market are stabilizing, this has got to be saying something's developing good in the market. So, and now you've got Silver Standard up to an RSI of 75, yeah, 75. And when it's that high, the best of the move is in. So it's lots of momentum. Of course, sentiment's been good. So we think that on a near-term basis, the best is in for the explosive move out of Christmas time. And one could take some money off the table and look for opportunities in a few months' time. You started off by wondering about inflation and deflation, and if you got a minute, we could do a quick one on that. The thing about that the ordinary, the interventionist economists and central banks get all confused about is that in their mind, inflation is only a rise in the consumer price index and the wholesale prices behind that. They just don't grasp that you can have inflation in financial assets. So there's a lot of people in our business are looking at the horrendous recklessness of the central banks, and particularly the Fed. And there's an idea that somewhere in a year or so, all of that recklessness is going to come out and drive commodity prices to the moon. But our view is sort of based on history, and we realize that an aggressive central bank has to have a bid for speculative assets in order to get the money supply out. And as we've noted from 2011 until this winter, there wasn't much of a speculative bid in precious metals. But the inflation was going on pretty strongly in stock and lower-grade bond prices. So this plus a revival in real estate essentially provided the speculative bid that the Fed needed in order to get its money supply out. So I think it's going to be like 2008 when all the paper goes down, then the Fed can't inflate, and they then have a problem. So I think that what I can leave our listeners with is that if people have got to understand financial asset inflation and tangible asset inflation, and sometimes they go together and sometimes they don't. And in back in the first part of, I think it was April or May of 2011, we have an unusual long-term indicator, and it went up and gave the signal that the speculation in then commodities and precious metals was on a huge speculative surge, unique. Hadn't been seen, well, you know, in ages, back in the 80s and 70s. So anyways, That then suggested at least a cyclical bear market for base and precious metals, which we have had. And that indicator, unfortunately, doesn't work. It only works at tops. It doesn't give you really good bottoms. So we can't at this stage call that this is an important low for many commodities, but they now have reached, like coffee went from $1.01 to, I don't know, 206. So all of these reached blow-off conditions in a brief time. But so we're not calling for a new bull market in most commodities, but we would be looking for a new bull market in precious metals based on the next contraction as it comes in. Now, this then gets us into wondering about the difference between silver and gold. And when you're on a bull market for both those metals, silver will outperform gold. And this is reliable. So, but on this rally out of Christmas, silver has not been outperforming gold. So our view is that if you look at the gold-silver ratio, and it's about 65 now, it's 56. I'll just bring that up in a moment here. Get so many numbers. Yeah, 65. If it trades above 66, which is the resistance, then silver will be seriously underperforming gold. And oftentimes when you're going into a problem in the credit markets, silver will do a sudden drop relative to gold, and that's one of the signposts. So, and it has a tendency when it's sort of acting like a credit spread to overwhelm all the guys who look at supply-demand analysis on the metals. So we're watching that one. Like I say, if it gets right through 56 and into 57, that would be suggesting that the next credit contraction is coming along, in which case silver would underperform gold.
I'd like your big picture outlook, if you could, please. This concept that we may be in a worldwide bubble on many different indices, everything ranging from the bond bubble that you've talked about on this show, as well as equities, and let's not forget that multi-trillion-dollar market currencies.
Chris, this is a bubble of expectations, and people are desperate to get as much money out of financial instruments as they can, particularly low-grade bonds. This is reaching for a yield that is just incredible. And then you've had, a five-year bull market in stocks, and that's really good. But you are also on a bubble in politics. And this is showing up particularly in the interventionist economic side and central banking. These guys are absolutely desperate to prove that their theories that they can manage the economy are correct. We all know that they're not. So you might get an unraveling on that on a cyclical basis. Now, the other political mania out there is this global warming thing. And the IPCC, which is the body that was set up by the United Nations back in the 90s, and it was sort of straightforward at the beginning. They put together this committee to assess all of the papers and data out there on climate change and then come up with recommendations, but it became corrupted by people who want to build big government. So the only answer to these perceived problems in global warming or climate change is a bigger state. So they intend to change the world's climate through fascism, because as Mussolini described, fascism is the combination of big business and big government. So, and it's a wonderful story for ambitious governments. And but here we are. We're running into. Actually, I took a degree in geophysics years ago, and of course, within the field is ice ages. And the understanding of Ice Age and mechanism really fell into place in the 70s and 80s, essentially the amount of energy from the sun and the amount of energy that reaches the Earth's surface. And you had the highest solar output in more than 1,000 years, sort of peaking back in the 60s and 70s. More recently, solar cycle 23, which had an unusual low a number of years ago, was the lowest solar cycle since the early 1913s, or since the 1913s. And it was interesting because the other day I wrote down a note that if you take the January, February months in the contiguous United States, it's now clocked. Guess what? The coldest January and February since 1913. So we have Mother Nature working on some cooling, and the average temperature of the globe, whichever one you want to look at, essentially been going sideways for 17 years. And this was predictable because two solar physicists, Matt and Penn and Livingston, back in the late 90s, had done work on the sun and had suggested that the sun was going to go into a solar minimum for some time, which has worked out. And, of course, anybody who took any physics would know that as the heat from the sun declines, the temperature in the Earth is going to stop going up. So the fascinating thing, Chris, is that Mother Nature is tending to those who have the audacity to imagine that they can control the climate of the Earth. And the other thing is that Mother Nature in the financial markets came in with a 1929 or 1873 type of crash. Even the establishment said that this was the worst recession since the 1930s, and they're looking at the recovery. I got no problem with the recovery that's been on for 5 years, and they're saying that it's been the weakest since the 1930s. So Mother Nature's providing an instruction there. So they've been crazy, these interventionists, and but I think they're going to have another comeuppance. So we'll see what happens to this cooling trend that has been on. And remember, we didn't talk about it, but even the summer months were unusually cool within the contiguous United States, with something like about 2,500 weather stations reporting record lows and about 700 weather stations reporting record highs. So I think this cooling regime will continue. And it'll, at some point, instruct governments about their ambitions. And then, we don't know when it's going to start, the next business contraction, who knows, 2 or 3 months from now, we might have a better reading on it. And here's where the public's going to take a look at the government and say, look at trillions of dollars you put us on the line for in order to make a perfect economy. And we have horrendous unemployment numbers, and now we're in, when we get there, another recession. So I think that we're on the close to the start of a new age for a new bull market for common sense. And all the public has to do is take a look at what's going on. If temperatures continue to not advance according to the theories, then the theories are wrong. And if we get a recession, and despite all the efforts by interventionist central banks, then their theories are wrong. And eventually the public's going to grab it, and it'll be great. So you can mark me down as being an optimist. On the political side, the experiment in authoritarian government has been on for more than 100 years. It started in the early 1900s.
I think it began there with The Creature from Jekyll Island, of course.
I'm rereading that one now. Particularly the introduction about how those guys quietly and secretly snuck down to have their meetings and J.P. Morgan's man and Warburg, various people.
You know, it's so funny you should mention that because I guess it passed in 1913, but I think it took a couple of years, and they finally pushed it through. I believe it was on Christmas Eve, or at least the Christmas break of 1913, when most of the representatives were simply back home.
It was snuck through, and they opened the doors in January 1914, and the depreciation of the U.S. dollar since then, I think it's now down to about 3.5 cents.
Very close, yeah, about 96.5% lost purchasing power due to the just unshackling from a precious metal standard. I mean, there's just inevitable. I mean, I guess it's a broken record now, but that when you unshackle a currency from some type of standard that's based in something tangible like gold or silver, preferably, I think you'd agree, a bimetallic standard, which we had for quite the longest time. And you might recall back in the 1800s that amazing speech, "We'll not be crucified on this cross of gold."
Oh, that was William Jennings Bryan, something close to that. And also he, in Wilson's cabinet, was the Secretary of the Navy, I think, or something like that. And he invited the Swiss Navy to a big deal.
And you know, what was really going on there is that the moneyed banking interests on the East, they preferred the gold standard, whereas the farmers and the smaller mom-and-pop SNLs and bank branches throughout the Midwest and, yeah, much of the country, they preferred the silver standard because it was the money of the everyday farmer and the everyday person. And so then William Jennings Bryan came along and said, "We can't allow this." And he just narrowly missed being elected. And as a result, you know, the moneyed interest essentially grabbed control of the monetary standard. I mean, we can go all the way back to the foundation of the country where we've had numerous banking wars.
Wildcat banking break out against land in 1837, and then there was another wildcat banking in 1857. But, you know, if you want to look at the really big picture, I mentioned that we're 100 years plus in this experiment in authoritarian government, and in 2,000 years there's only been two other examples. And in what would be called the senior economy, and the first one was the 3rd century in Rome, where it had been a republic, and then it was sort of an empire, but it took 100 years, from 200 to 300 A.D., to really trash it and turn it into a police state. And then it collapsed. But then the next outbreak in high inflation and authoritarian government was in the 1500s, where it was the conquered bullion that came over from the New World. Spain was the supreme power. And that experiment, unlimited government, required unlimited funds, and so they depreciated the currency and borrowed money like crazy, went defaulted about three times during the 1500s. So the illustration is that when you're on an experiment in unlimited government, even unlimited inflation eventually comes to an end. So the whole purpose of the Fed has been to fund another experiment in unlimited government. So we want to go back to see the motivation of what really caused the corruption in Rome in the 3rd century. And, well, what it was is the ambition of the bureaucracy. They liked running things, and they saw all that wealth that had come in through conquest and tribute. But it wasn't enough to satisfy ambition, so then they took to a horrendous price inflation, and they destroyed the economy. Practical people left.
Exactly, and let's not forget how they debased the currencies by slowly removing the precious metal and diluting. Of course, they had a massive military, as we know today. I mean, they had military outposts as far as Scotland. The parallels are striking.
The ambition of the bureaucrats destroyed it, and eventually people left. And you know how long it took? 100 years. So here we are now, and then in the 1500s, it took a little over 100 years before the public figured it out and said enough of big government, so that your early 1600s was a nasty time in Europe, but it was less nasty in England, where the public eventually ended the inflation and ended the authority of the state, and you eventually had in 1688 the Glorious Revolution, where they took on Charles II and 1688, sorry, James II, and he was authoritarian, he was Catholic, and he was going to bring in French troops to subdue British citizens, and business interests in London said no, and they went over to Holland and got William of Orange. He came over, they appointed him king, people rallied around him, and as somebody said at the time, it was a close-run thing, and then that was the end of absolutism in England. So here we are now in the United States. You have the equivalent of a British king in heading up the White House on a absolutely absurd experiment in order to destroy the middle class and destroy the economy of the United States. Talk to liberals, they can't believe it, but if you read about Saul Alinsky, you know what this guy's up to. But he still, like either Philip in Spain or King James in England, they have to face the financial market.
As we bring this all together today, we were hearing similar things in the 70s and early 80s, that the end was nigh, currencies would be destroyed, it would fill your backyard filled with junk silver, and people are still digging up yards and putting in pipes today and finding huge stockpiles of silver that had been essentially buried back in the 70s and early 80s. So can you tell folks and listeners today who are convinced that maybe we are close to the end game, tell folks how it's different now 30, 35 years later?
I was there, and these concerns, you wanted to buy extra cans of groceries, and you wanted to have a little place away out in the bush where you could be away from the threat. But the threat is in Washington, D.C. The threat is in Ottawa, Canada, or the threat is in Sacramento, California, you know, the state capitals. And there's a devolution developing here whereby, in California, for example, you've got different regions want to break away. The public wants to get away from the authoritarians in the big cities. And it's a very healthy move. And the middle-class people have got to stop and fight it. In the 70s and 80s, the idea of having a retreat somewhere was running away from it. Now, there's no place to go because back in the 70s, you could believe that there were banking havens in Switzerland or the Grand Caymans. You can't hide your money. And there's no place to hide. Even if you go up in the bush of British Columbia, the authoritarians can still get at you. So the beauty of it, Chris, is that the public, at least the caring public, the middle class who likes its lifestyle, has got to stand on its hind feet and say, no, enough. And so how's it going to do it? It's going to take a look on the next recession at the central bankers and say, out of here. And perhaps they will even force a gold standard, in which case the public is selecting the money it chooses to transact in. And then the same with you get another a year or so of not advancing global temperatures, and the public's going to take a look at the government and say, you guys were over your head, you didn't know what you're talking about, you're out of here. So I think that the change can happen politically. The public will seek self-government. I mean, America was started on the concept of self-government. And the ambitions of the current White House as well, Obama and his teleprompter know how to run your life. So he's even said that he knows more about policy than his policy advisors do. So this is a crazy experiment, and it will fail. And the public has the ability to determine that failure. You look at in Eastern Europe in the 80s, they took a look in East Germany, saw what the governing classes, how they were living, and looked at the promises from the governing classes, looked at the amount of money they were taking out of the system, and said, enough. And they stared down border guards with AK-47s. And the point then is that if you go back to 1956 with the Hungarian uprising, and the Soviets sent in the tanks, and there was great bloodshed. In 1968, the folks in Czechoslovakia, particularly in Prague, had a taste for freedom, and they sent in the tanks, and it was bloody. Now, in the late 80s, it was the same uprising for freedom, and at one time, Jaruzelski, who was the dictator in Poland, and Gorbachev talked about sending in the tanks, at least I read that, and they didn't. So, and they won't, and sure, you got a blow up in Ukraine now, but I take that as Russia's about to lose a key important part of its territory, Ukraine. They may keep the eastern portion, and they will definitely end up with that seaport. But this is another devolution. So once the experiment in centralization ends, you have regions spinning apart, and you also have a shift in political sentiment away from central government and to the individual. We live in exciting times, very exciting times, and that's how we started this.
Well, it's been a very illuminating conversation. I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services you provide, as well as any contact information you'd like to share.
Stock markets, credit markets, metals, commodities and interest rates and precious metals, the whole thing, on a big overview basis. And then our technical work is absolutely outstanding. And they come out whenever there's trading opportunities. And like on Sunday, we came out with the huge valuations on the precious metals. So we're looking now for the correction. You can get in touch with us through institutionaladvisors.com. That's O-R-S at the end. Or actually, just Google B-O-B-H-O-Y, Bob Hoy, and it gets us into the system. And we have institutional subscribers. We have money managers. We've got mining people, and we have a lot of high net worth people. And you can take, we put people on the mailing list for 4 or 5 weeks. And if you like the service, you come on board.
And I understand that, Bob, that you might just have a couple of very interesting automobiles, vintage, classic cars that maybe one or two of our listeners today might not be able to do without. Tell us more.
Well, I'm at an age to have three old collector's cars is more than I need. So I have a 1962 Alfa Romeo Spider. That's the convertible. And this thing is set up for... it is still a very respectable handling sports car. It's got a later model 2-liter engine in it, so it's fairly quick. Then the other one is its brother, you might say, the Sprint Coupe. It's 1963. And both cars are concours classes. The convertible was in a serious concours and came in third place in Italian. And the coupe is just sort of being finished from a multi-year restoration, and it's coming out as a concours car. So they're beautiful cars, and if anybody's interested, then just get in touch with me or through you, and I always love to talk about cars.
Isn't that something? I miss my car days. You know, the teenage years, I had a 74 Plymouth Roadrunner with a hood scoop on it, 344 barrel quadrajet with a slapstick transmission and a moonroof, a leather moonroof, and jet black interior with, yeah, the suede Naga hide seats were, everything was immaculate. And I bought it for $400. And I thought I was a rocket scientist when I sold it for $600. I made 50%. Unfortunately, if I'd held it, it'd probably be worth about $60,000 today.
Well, listen, I'll tell you how you offset that one.
Okay.
Just imagine the rent at $50 a month to have had it in the garage all through that. Chris, good to be with you. Look forward to the next one.
Charles Goyette penned a New York Times bestseller as well as his latest Red, Blue, and Broke All Over, Restoring America's Free Economy. Currently editor of the Freedom and Prosperity Letter. Hello, Charles Goyette.
Chris, great to speak with you again. And please mention the work that I do with Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, right.
The weekly podcast, daily radio commentaries. Those are accessible at podcast1.com, the weekly podcast.
Very good. We'll have the links up, and I guess we'll discuss that a bit more in detail at the end of the discussion today.
Great.
Well, let's start off with the gold market. You know, you note that demand for physical gold is booming, and you liken the impact of the gold market on financial markets to that of tectonic plate shifts, or more colloquially known as earthquakes. Tell us how this could send reverberations across, well, the markets.
Well, to extend the geologic metaphor, I think what we're really seeing is a huge, unnoticed, for the most part, subterranean flow of precious metals from the West, from Europe and the United States, to the Orient, to China. This is going on under the nose of the American people who are, you know, indifferent and in a state of neglect about all monetary issues. But in the Far East, in places from India to China, they take their money very seriously, and they take precious metals as money more seriously still. So we are seeing in real terms, in terms of not fiat money, but real money, we are seeing a gradual decapitalization of the West and a recapitalization of the Far East. And this spells a change, which I liken to a tectonic plate shift, a change in the dominance and influence of the affairs of humankind going forward from the Western world to the Eastern world. I'm not telling you that that's a bad thing necessarily, that the contributions of the Eastern world may not at some point surpass what we have accomplished here in the West. But I will tell you that if you live in the West and you see your fortunes diminishing, you see your lifestyle will be going down, you know that the end of the dollar reserve standard around the world means a lessening of your standard of living as well and the purchasing power of your currency.
Well, we're certainly seeing the golden magma flow from the West to the East, but you know, we're not seeing that flow. It's blocked, apparently, in the Atlantic, under the Atlantic Ocean there, maybe in one of the trenches. It's pooling because, for some reason, the Bundesbank can't get its gold back, no matter how hard it tries. So, you know, we're hearing that they only received 5 tons of gold. That may sound like a lot. They're recasting all gold bars that return. There are some rumors that there may be some tungsten-filled bars. And now, at this current pace, 5 tons, that is, a year, we're looking at 60 years to repatriate gold that should have already been returned in total. I'd like your thoughts on this.
Yes, the plot thickens. And I actually, Chris, resent this a great deal because over the years, in calling for what are simply prudent business measures that every hair salon in America would take to audit their books, to double-check the figures, and so on and so forth, have been cast as quackery when recommended for the Federal Reserve. You cannot get an honest audit of the Federal Reserve or the gold holdings of the United States, and people like myself and yourself, I presume, that have raised this issue, have been diminished by being referred to as, you know, tinfoil hat wearers and so on and so forth. This is extremely frustrating that the most basic of business prudency can't be applied to the largest financial enterprise on the face of the planet or in the history of mankind, the Federal Reserve. And I have encountered this in the form of belittling comments or remarks. What do you think, Charles, that somebody backed up a truck in the middle of the night and took the gold out? No. But as we are becoming more and more curious, it appears that there may be multiple claims. You know, when you do an audit, it's not just counting the bars to make sure that all the bars are there. You would, in fact, check to spot check them to see if, indeed, there are any bars with tungsten. You would actually, even more importantly in my view, find out if title to them is clear or if it has been compromised, if that gold has been used as a part of unaudited financial operations, if it has been pledged, used in loans, in swap arrangements, and other financial shenanigans. And so, of course, we don't know exactly why Germany can't get its gold back and what the delay is. It sure raises suspicions that there is something amiss because they have so mightily resisted the basics of business prudency in the form of an audit for so long. Our suspicions are doubled.
It's not just that central bank that has its own concerns about the purity of the bullion that's returning or being repatriated. Now the BOC, the Bank of China, is recasting all of its gold bars. Why can't the Federal Reserve and the Treasury simply step into the market and slowly accumulate these bars if they don't want to send the bars that are supposedly in their vaults and send that to Europe? Calls on the COMEX exchange or the Shanghai exchange ensure that Germany will receive its metal. Something doesn't pass the smell test here.
Let's look at it carefully, because the central banking is built on the basis of one presupposition, and that presupposition, the entire philosophy undergirding central banking, is fractionalism, fractional reserve banking. So are we to be surprised if the edifice is built on the concept of fractional reserve banking, that multiples of deposits can be loaned out because depositors won't all line up at once? It's the law of large numbers that some will come in to redeem their deposits, but they all won't line up. Therefore, we can make hay by loaning their money out over and over again. Are we to be surprised if fractionalism or fractional reserve banking is not employed by the central banks of the world as well? Well, of course it is. So with respect to gold, they've gotten away with this, whatever their monetary practices are or their lending practices of gold, for a very long time without oversight, for a very long time without audit. Are we suddenly surprised to think that, they may have actually compromised the title by using it to secure more transactions than there is actual gold in the vaults to secure? I mean, the United States has a history of this. The United States has been floating bad checks around the world for a very long time. We got caught up in 1971 when Richard Nixon realized we had issued so many bad checks promising that they were redeemable. The United States was doing it to countries all over the world, and when they lined up to redeem those checks at the gold window, there was no gold.
Hugo Chavez, one of his last edicts was the repatriation of all of Venezuela's gold. Lesser known is that Mexico is requesting back its gold. Obviously, the Bundesbank sent most of its gold to Paris, London, and New York due to the Red Scare several decades earlier. That's no longer seen as a threat. Is the new scare rehypothecation, swapping and leasing? I'd like your thoughts.
Well, I can tell you that the rhetoric that the gold standard is outdated, that it's forgotten, that nobody cares about it, that it's a relic of the past, and so on, is eyewash for the public. Because the truth is that governments in the real world never go off the gold standard. You saw the story, no doubt, a week or so ago, that in the middle of the night, faced with Russians intent on securing their position in Crimea, that the new government of Kiev loaded up an airplane. Their details included how many men, how many cars, how many trucks, loaded up an airplane in the middle of the night with the central bank's gold, and delivered by cars that had trucks that had their license plates removed, and men in black uniforms with no insignia or identifying marks on them, and flew it off in the middle of the night with not so much as a public how do you do to the United States for safekeeping. Now, they did not secure the pallets of their failing national currency, did they? Or the currency printing presses or printing plates, for that matter. No. When in the real world, when in faced with a crisis and a desire for resources, in the real world, governments always look to gold. And they always secure their deals. When Germany loans money to Portugal, they ask secretly for security in the form of gold. So, you know, this is for the public, the idea that that gold does no longer have a part of our monetary system. We see the proof is in the pudding, and in the pudding, it's even the governments themselves and the central banks in a crisis want gold first.
Were I the leader, I would have gone for London or even Paris. I wouldn't have even considered the United States, given the track record with the Bundesbank. But there has been some speculation in the blogosphere that perhaps this entire event, or at least an aspect of this event, the tensions between, I'm referring to Ukraine, Crimea, and of course Russia, may have been fomented as an attempt to extricate the gold from that nation. I mean, we're no longer on such tense terms with Russia, the United States. Is that too far out?
I don't know that it's too far out, but with respect to why they would ship the gold to the United States, it's clear to me that the authorship of the entire revolution is the handiwork of the United States. Victoria Nuland has admitted as much. Billions of dollars spent, the taxpayers' money spent on fomenting revolution and toppling the government in Ukraine. We have, you know, a former senior analyst of the CIA told me the other day, he said the things that CIA operations used to do with respect to the Mossad government, for example, in Iran or Guatemala or whatever it may be, are not done by operations of the CIA now. They're done by the National Endowment for Democracy. And so we have 60 National Endowment for Democracy type operations that have been ongoing in Ukraine at the cost. Well, Russia's estimate is that we've been spending, I believe they think we're spending $5 million a week to subvert conditions in Ukraine. So we are clearly the authors of the situation there. And if you have any doubt about that, all you have to do is go listen to the tape of Assistant Secretary of State Veronica Nuland. It's the tape that the media cared about because she used a four-letter word. But the media did not seem to bestir itself about the propriety of the United States Assistant Secretary of State and the ambassador to Ukraine choosing who would be the next head of state, with an election looming this spring and designating among a populist candidate, somebody the people loved, and a central banker that the United States loved, and another candidate still among them, designating, "We want Yats," said Nuland. "We want, no, Yats is our guy. The other guys are going to have to clip their wings and just get in line, and Yats is our guy." And 2 weeks later, lo and behold, Yats is in charge, and the plot thickens. We had, you know, this is also an unverified story, but it has a fair amount of currency, and there may be truth to it. I suspect where there's some smoke, there's something else going on. Purportedly, the prime minister, I believe, of one of the Baltic republics, and it may have been Estonia, told a commissioner of the European community that the sharpshooters, the snipers that were in Liberty Square in Kiev, that were shooting people, that how many people died in that short-lived revolution? About 60 people were shot. That the shooters, the sharpshooters, the snipers in that event were shooting people on both sides without regard to their alliance, because the objective apparently, and we know this technique has been used many, many times in history, if you want to bestir people into a revolution, you start, you know, creating some casualties and hardening people's positions and angering the mobs and so on, purportedly shooting people from both sides. And the head of the European community said, well, I'm going to have to look into that. That would be great if they looked into that. I would love to get the information on it. But who benefits from it? Russia didn't want it. Who has the resources that has been fomenting revolutions like that anyway?
And this story goes back. I mean, there's some teeth to this. We're talking decades that Wall Street benefited and financed both sides of the conflict from. So there was money to be made. War is a racket.
It was Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler. Of course it's a racket. And one has to only look up Operation Northwoods here in the United States to realize that people at the highest levels of the United States government were perfectly willing to kill American civilians, innocent American citizens, to create a pretext for war with an enemy. We want an invasion of Cuba, can't justify it. Let's kill a bunch of Americans and claim that Cuba did it, and then we'll have a pretext for war. This got through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
But now we read in the Telegraph this week, this could end up as a new Cold War. And of course, there's money to be made there.
You know, you have a defense budget, an ever-growing defense budget that has to be justified. So let me ask you, I mean, if your objective was to start a new Cold War, I suppose, well, let me ask you some of the things that you might do. Would you think about, instead of dismantling your Cold War military alliance, with the Cold War ended, do you think you might even expand it, even though it was created to fight the Warsaw Pact, to check the Warsaw Pact, which nobody exists? Do you think you might actually extend and grow your military alliance? Do you think, in fact, you might expand it right onto your designated enemy's doorstep, despite your own assurances at the time that if they would remove their troops from Germany and let Eastern Europe go free, that you would not expand NATO? Do you think you might expand it to their doorsteps? With the Cold War ended, do you think you might even expand it, even though it was created to fight the Warsaw Pact, to check the Warsaw Pact, which nobody exists, do you think you might actually extend and grow your military alliance? Do you think, in fact, you might expand it right onto your designated enemy's doorstep, despite your own assurances at the time that if they would remove their troops from Germany and let Eastern Europe go free, that you would not expand NATO? Do you think you might expand it to their doorsteps if you wanted a new Cold War? Do you think you might ramp up your military budget all out of proportion to any reality? Do you think you might spend hundreds of millions of dollars on operations that are designed to stir up the factions in countries next door on the border of your intended enemy? And for all your talk of democracy in response to a referendum that you didn't like anyway, you didn't like the outcome, do you think you might institute trade sanctions of the kind that are always a prelude to more trouble down the road? Do you think you would do things like that if you wanted to foment a new Cold War? I suppose those are the sorts of things you might do.
And you might just improve that sluggish employment situation in your country, and you might increase your gross domestic product, which has also been lackluster, and it might offset some of China's slowing growth that has everybody nervous with their manufacturing sector. Shift back to the precious metals more specifically. You know, some analysts are pegging the cost of mining silver at around $20 an ounce. But prices were below that level for quite some time. And we're also seeing record demand for silver coins from the U.S. Mint, which has really quadrupled recently. One source claiming silver mine production was disrupted, though, due to those mining costs we talked about. How significant do you think this disruption in mining may be? I mean, have we closed enough mines? Has production been reduced enough to where we might see a sustainable rally just on its own merits?
Well, I will tell you, Chris, I'm very, very bullish on silver. And I only have one piece of insight that I will share with your listeners to justify that. You have seen with the depressed price of silver, as far as it has fallen and so on, for the length that it has fallen, you have seen the price of silver assimilating the depression in Europe and the slowdown in China now for the last couple of years. And this is what markets are prone to do, is to discount conditions as they are in development. On the other hand, you have what I view, the price of silver has been a reflection of its industrial quality, but you cannot look at silver the way you can look at almost anything else in the economy, because it has a longer monetary history than even gold. And if you will remember, and I know you will, I know this from being up close, in fact, tangentially related to the story, it only took, I was going to say a handful, I'm going to say a dozen, fewer than a half a dozen billionaires around the world to awaken to the monetary virtues of silver in an era of reckless fiat monetary policies. Only less than a half a dozen billionaires around the world to begin to view silver as a monetary commodity to send its price through the roof. And I believe that the evidence is very clear that something like this is happening again. I don't identify for you, and I don't think that they have anybody has stepped forward on a program like this, but you see evidence that the world is awakened to silver's monetary virtues. It's very slim. It's just a glimmer on the horizon. But, you know, as the government of India tried to quash interest in gold, it stampeded people in India to silver as a monetary commodity, as a reaction to monetary conditions. In addition to that, we have the amazingly robust sales of silver coins that you alluded to earlier. This is a reflection of a psychology or an understanding of silver by the people, the strong hands. Mind you, these are strong hands who buy these things, because these buyers of silver intend to hold it. They are not hedge funds that buy this and then they're on to iPhones next week and so on and so forth. They're not momentum chasers. Clearly, they're strong hands, and it sounds funny for me to tell people that the hedge fund buyers of, for example, gold or silver for that matter, are weak holders, but the people that are buying gold in China James Rickards, the Currency Wars author, with whom I share a publisher, says, you know, that gold goes to China. It goes underground where it is kept for the next 300 or 400 years.
That's right.
These are strong holders, whereas the holders in the United States, the hedge funds and the ETFs, are weak holders because they will sell it in a moment for a margin call for something else or for a new opportunity. So you see that with silver. Now, my view is that the silver coin buying is not enough in the total volume to move the market individually as much as to indicate to us a changing psychology about silver, just as India is. But there's one more piece of evidence. If you look at the ETF holdings of gold and silver, I think there were 700 tons of gold that moved out of ETFs in the last couple of years.
It all went to China. You're right.
And it all went to China. But if you look at the chart of silver holdings at the ETFs, they actually, it's during part of that period, they rose, and for the most part, they were flat. While gold was precipitously lower, silver holdings of ETFs remained flat or actually trended just a bump or two higher. I think this is enormously significant because those holders of silver are not commodity buyers that are using it to make electronics next month or a year down the road. They don't have an industrial demand for it and so on. This is something else entirely. This represents a new slow awakening of people to the idea that in an era thick with monetary risk, that silver has performed admirably for many thousands of years.
Other reports are showing that the London gold fix may be broken. This, of course, was the standard used by the industry, insiders, central banks, to value the price of gold. Some sources are saying, though, that it's just been manipulated for too long. There are some investigations underway. We're basically looking at Barclays, Deutsche Bank, Bank of Nova Scotia, HSBC, and Société Générale, suspected of manipulating this $20 trillion gold market. The rate setting began in 1919. We're coming up on the 100-year anniversary of the process. Is this a significant piece of the puzzle?
Do they manipulate interest rates? Do we know, for example,
the LIBOR?
Of course, they manipulated LIBOR. Have you ever seen? I think Adam Smith's line was, you know, you don't get two businessmen together before they, you know, start to conspire against the public interest and to enrich themselves. I have never believed the propriety of the London gold fix. I've always been suspicious about that. But my view is, and having lived, as I said, through the Bunker Hunt silver episode and watched the exchanges operate as partisans of their board members into one side of the market versus impartiality with regard to buyers and sellers, I believe that all of these markets and quasi-market institutions of this sort, institutional markets like this, are fixed. And perhaps I'm wrong, but I think people are armed if they are justly suspicious that they may be. And so my assumption is you go into it, you assume that they're conspiring on their own behalf rather than yours.
And as we wrap up here today, you know, we do have an FOMC meeting slated. I wanted to get your thoughts on the new Fed chair, Dr. Yellen, as well as all of the concerns over tapering. You know, we've seen a bit of a tick up in the unemployment rate that was unexpected, not anything significant, but we're still shy of that 6.5% target rate at the Fed. So I'd kind of like your thoughts on whether or not you expect them to pull in the reins somewhat on the stimulus, or are they really holding a weak hand and the river card will essentially show us, well, we need more stimulus. What do you think?
Yeah, they may continue another month or so, but I think they're very reluctant to continue it much longer. If you look at Yellen, if you look at the addition of the vice chairman now, Fisher, you know, these people are back-to-the-wall inflationists. But you're right, the employment numbers are nothing but confusing. I think even more significant is in the face of a China slowdown that is becoming something more than a slowdown and is becoming increasingly apparent to everyone. This is like an ocean liner that goes down and sucks in everything around it. I mean, the eddies and the currents of destruction around the sinking of China could be very, very great indeed. And it has implications for the United States and our economic resiliency as well, not to mention, you know, questions that we're talking about, the funding of American debt and so on. So I think that, you know, that in public pronouncements, you know, they would like to assume the posture that they are confident in the decision that they have embarked upon to continue to taper. But I am not in the least convinced. I think that every fiber of their Keynesian beings is screaming for more money pumping, because they know very well that the China situation is real, that the unemployment situation remains to be seen, and that the American economy, not to mention the movement of $104 billion out of foreign holdings of U.S. Treasuries at the Federal Reserve this past week.
No, I think it's well said. You know, I think we're entering that neoclassical nightmare, the worst of world scenario that I refer to as stagflation, because that's where the models break down. You don't want to be in a situation where stimulus just doesn't have the impact that it did before. It loses its efficacy. And I think that's where we are, inflation. Okay, I'm watching the grocery bills going up. I'm watching tuition bills go up, rent bills, everything. Everything's going through the roof.
Well, you just look at the Tuesday morning, the front page of the Tuesday morning Wall Street Journal. Arabica coffee up, I think, 49.5%. Just since the first of the year, we're talking, Chris, less than 3 months. And it goes on, you know, it's cattle, it's hogs, it's sugar, it's corn, it's wheat, it's just about every food commodity out there. And of course, it's a mistake for people to say, you know, to confuse inflation and price inflation, to say that there's no inflation if there's no consumer price inflation. We know there's inflation because classical economists and long history says inflation is an increase in the supply of money and credit. It does not have to manifest at once in consumer prices. It can perfectly well manifest in the cost of insurance or medical care, of education, the cost of government, on Wall Street and the bond market, which we've experienced this time. But that money is beginning to leak out, and it's beginning to become available at the level of consumer prices now. There will be a stampede into the markets that we've been talking about.
If we bring this together, the inflation we're referring to, as well as this stubbornly high unemployment number, I mean, the Fed's excited because we're under 7% unemployment. The labor participation rates at the St. Louis Fed, it's abysmal. It's a sinkhole, and the house is already missing. That worst of world scenario where the stimulus is not working as expected, and you have unbelievably higher rates, not just rates, but inflation, as you referred to, they still have to keep rates low, which is becoming increasingly expensive, requiring massive credit default swaps and other instruments behind the scenes, working through J.P. Morgan and others. But then you still have a huge number of people, tens of millions of people, who are eligible to work but cannot find meaningful work. They're accepting jobs that are simply insufficient. Why don't you tell folks a bit more about this exciting show you have with former Congressman Ron Paul, Dr. Paul, as well as your latest bestseller, please?
Well, we do a twice-a-day radio commentary. We're on well over 100 radio stations around the country twice a day, morning and afternoon drive, on events going on. It's a wonderful thing for people that have been hearing, you know, the conventional wisdom about news and economics and government and what's going on, to get a chance to hear a different perspective every day when they shower, every day when they pick up the kids after school or drive home, every day, day after day after day, instead of being propagandized by the conventional statist view that we all expect from the mainstream media, to get a different perspective on things. So if your local radio station doesn't carry Ron Paul's daily commentary, you ought to rattle somebody's chain there and get them to do so, and do your friends and neighbors in your community a favor. In addition to that, though, we do a once weekly podcast. The Ron Paul Weekly Podcast is available at a website called Podcast One. Podcast One, O-N-E, podcast1.com. And Chris, you're the first person I've told outside of friends and family that beginning this coming week, we are expanding the Ron Paul Weekly Podcast enormously turning it, because of people's hunger for news and information, the podcast has proved to be quite popular, and we're expanding it enormously with new additional content, and quite excited about it. So you can find it at podcastone.com.
Well, hat tip for all of that. I mean, we're getting the information out there. That's really exciting. And the more folks that become aware, you know, hopefully the less detrimental to society as this entire house of cards implodes in the next few years. So we're going to look forward to having you back on the show here.
Thank you, Chris. Always good to talk to you.